Okay, Boker Tov. Today we're getting into chapter 7, page 1258. I had my usual epiphany this week. I started teaching Megillat Esther in college, and I have a group about 20 students at Stern College in Yeshiva, and a couple of them come from Beis Yaakov, from schools in Brooklyn. And I started teaching them about the history of Megillat Esther, and I have to say I got the ultimate compliment. The ultimate compliment was, why didn't they tell us this in school? To me, it's always a compliment, because at least I know that they're learning something which they've never learned before. And the look of amazement on their faces is a picture, right? It would be inappropriate to take photos. On the other hand, I wish I could, because, you know, this kind of, when you show, remember we showed the whole historical development of Ahasuerus and how he started off being such a great emperor. By the time he's finished, he can barely hold it together in Shushan, right? We spoke about all of that. And I was teaching that this week, and I have to say, unbelievable. 20, 21, I mean, these are good students, you know. They know a lot, but in this context, they've never seen the Megillah as we've tried to present it, this very much bigger presentation, the bigger picture. And I'm glad that... Not 10 years old, but this could have had it when they were 16 or 17, when they were in 12th grade. There's no problem teaching this in 12th grade. But it wasn't meant to be. But, you know, it's just one of those things. I also, thinking this week, we had Holocaust Memorial Day, which in the secular calendar in Israel, it's always the 27th of Nisan. Outside Israel, they've now attached it, the International Holocaust Memorial, whatever they call themselves, to the date when Auschwitz was liberated, which was the 27th of January. And there was a very, very interesting memorial in London, in one of the big venues, Albert Hall, wherever it was attended by the Prime Minister, the Chief Rabbi, many members of the community, and Prince William and the Princess were there as well. All making speeches, and they lit candles, and they said, and there was a Kaddish, and there was a Kel Mole. It was really something to see. It was really something to see. And there's no question about it, this should be always something that we never forget, something that we don't have to be told that. We remember the people, and we certainly will never forget them, and hopefully we've learned some of the lessons of what happened when we're dealing with the situation today, when we just heard about a peace plan and what happened immediately. You know, one side says, oh, reject, absolute, not even looking at the page. As usual, I mean, it was almost expected, but how depressing that is when you're trying to talk one language and all they can come out with is hatred, hatred, hatred the whole time. They don't want to recognize the existence of Israel and essentially of the Jewish people. So I think we know where we are, but not in this generation. I think in Israel they've already come to terms with that, my impression in Israel is simply that, you know, peace discussions and peace talk, there's nobody to talk to, so you've got to wait another generation. But the younger generation are being influenced by the older generation. The schools are producing these awful stuff that they learn in school, which is all geared towards hating Jews. It's a terrible problem, and I don't know. Maybe we'll be surprised by what happens in the next few months. I hope we will be. For today, what we're going to do, we're going to read through chapter 7. It's a short perek, and we're going to talk about a couple of things. One of my favorite things is about the trees, right? We like to be worried about the environment, and the tree of Homo. Believe it or not, the Midrash has this wonderful discussion took place between all of the trees in Persia at the time, which tree is going to be the tree upon which Haman is going to be hanged. This is like last week we saw Mizmor Shir Hanukkah Bayit, right?
We were taught that he built a gallows.
Correct. But the question is, that tree that offered itself to be the gallows, there is, rabbinic literature is always amazes me, that they want to show that the, and I think this is the point, that nature is in tune with man. Meaning that the way God runs the world is that nature is there to serve man at the behest of the creator. In other words, God has created. So to me, it's like a computer with a computer program. Nature is the program, the world is the computer, but the programmer is God. Right? And therefore, what we're going to see is just an amazing discussion amongst all the different types of trees, which tree wants to hang Haman. And of course, most of them say we don't want it. We don't want to be the tree to hang Haman because, you know, he doesn't deserve the vine and he doesn't deserve this. It's just an interesting discussion. The other thing which I think is also blows my mind is about Charvona. We know we sing Shoshana Yaakov, the end of the Megillah. So who gets the real, according to the Ben Tzion Shen Katum, which everybody knows, right? Gam v'gam Charvona zachor latov. Charvona, he should be remembered for good. Now, if you read a little bit about Charvona and what he was involved with, he is one of the worst characters in the Megillah. He is not, as they say, a nice guy. He really is not. Good morning. And accordingly, when we're dealing with this story of Charvona, how are we supposed to understand him? What's the... And what is... Oh, okay. Wow. And what is the message? What is the message of Charvona? What... Oh, we're getting a bit of... That's an unusual noise. My goodness. That's all right. And we'll do a little bit of background. All right, we'll find out about him. Because we sing about him, we dance around about him, but what's going on? V'gam Charvona. What's the gam? What do you mean, also Charvona? All right, and there's an interpretation you'll see when we look at the actual text, what V'gam Charvona really means. So this is today's menu, and it's, again, stuff which, generally speaking, is not that well understood, but I hope by the end of today's presentation you'll be a bit more clued in to this particular discussion. So look at chapter 7. Again, page 1258. Look at this. It goes like this. But of course, remember, we're in the point between the first and the second meal. And the last thing we said last week was that Haman really wanted to take down the tree because he was told by his people, get it, knock it down because this is going to be something which can work against you. The king may very well see this as something which you're using in order to maybe sort of highlight the weakness of the king. You know, you're hanging Mordechai. Mordechai did something which was good to the king, so you are, by definition, making a statement against the king by hanging him. So Haman rushes into the garden, takes his axe and starts chopping down the tree, or whatever he built, the gallows, and then, of course, he doesn't have time, because he's rushed to the second meal. Right? And why a second meal? Remember, we spoke about this, the idea of Amalek, the way you deal with Amalek, machar. You wait. You don't react immediately. You weigh up your options. You have to understand how to deal with him. You work it out. And then you go ahead and you react accordingly. So it's just kind of interesting how all of this information is going to all sort of blend into chapter 7 and beyond. So listen to this. This is really entertaining. Pasuk Aleph, chapter 7. V'yavah melech v'haman lishtod im Esther Malkah. Remember we said a Malkah. The use of the term queen was significant because originally Ahasuerus, Xerxes, did not want to marry anyone who had yichus. He had enough of that with Vashti, right? She was enough yichus for a lifetime. And look what trouble she gave him. So this is part of the discussion about Esther not revealing who she is, according to some opinions. And we said that eventually Ahasuerus realizes that Esther is a malka. She has this quality of king, of being a queen, right? There is an aura about her. There is a presence. And as I mentioned, you know, this is something you see today when you come into the presence of royalty. There's something special about that. Okay, this is the whole issue with the couple now going to live in Canada. You know, how can you stop being royalty? How can you stop having the paparazzi chasing after you? I don't know how it's going to happen. They're going to have to live somewhere in Ekvel, you know, we're in the middle of the... And even there they'll find them. So it's just strange. You can't shake it off. And now, as far as Achashverosh is concerned, Esther Malka, she's established, she has a royal status. And that again is interesting. She's become, you know, she's grown into that position, but of course we know that she comes from royalty, she comes from the descended from Shaul. There's a beautiful statement in the Talmud, it's actually on the page in front of you that I gave you, which says that why was Esther so blessed with the way that she handled this situation, because she descended from Shaul. So you'll say to me, no, so what was the thing with Shaul? So it turns out that when you look at the story of Shaul, it's the most amazing thing. When Shaul is appointed as king of Israel, beginning of Shmuel Aleph, what does Shaul do? He accepts the appointment reluctantly, and it's in the middle of a story. If you remember, he's looking for some animals. Animals ran away from his father's field, and he's running around looking for these donkeys or horses or whatever they are. And in the midst of all of that, he meets up with Shmuel, and he's appointed the king of Israel in the middle of all of that. And he goes home after the whole business with Shmuel, and he's told he's going to be the king, and there's going to be a formal installation and all this sort of thing. Shaul goes home, and he meets his uncle. And his uncle says, "No, Shauli, where have you been?" So Shaul says, "I was looking for the animals." And Shaul fails to mention, "Oh, by the way, I've just been made the king of Israel." He doesn't say that. He keeps quiet. Now you'd say to me, you know, if someone has got that sort of achievement, you know, he'd be announcing, he'd have the t-shirt, "I am the new king," you know, and he hasn't said a word. And the rabbis say, when it comes to Shaul, there was a tremendous sense of humility and modesty. And one of the things that I wanted to show you in these presentations is that the historical precedent repeats itself over and over again. Maaseh Avot Siman LaBanim. What happens to the previous generation continues to the next and beyond. And this is what's going on here. Shaul sets the precedent of modesty. He doesn't want to shout about his achievement. He doesn't want to scream it from the rooftops, because you know what? He's a modest guy, he's a humble guy. And that is something which is fascinating. Yes?
Which other ancestors acted that way?
It goes back to Rachel. And again, it's all about Rachel also.
Right down.
But he says the big Indian here was Shaul. Right? That Shaul was really... not to announce to his uncle, to say, "Oh, by the way, you know, I just met Shmuel, and he told me I'm going to be the king." He doesn't say a word. The Simanim and all of that. So they say Rachel is... this is on the page that I gave you about Sniut. I'll just show you the paragraph. You see on the page I gave you, page 1, there is Bishar Sniut. I don't know, do you have the page? I'm not sure if you have it. Let me just give it to you here. It's these small paragraphs. Sorry, it's in small print. Just bear with me on the size of the print. It's Bat Malachim Anami Beit Shaul Kartina. She says to Achashverosh, "I come from the house of Shaul." This is when she lets him know not only she's Jewish, but what her yichus is. These are the two small paragraphs about a third of the way down. Bischardzni, this is all taken from Gemara Megillah. Also Agadat Esther, so it's taken from a Midrash. And I'll just read it to you. Bischardzniut shaita ba berachel zachta v'yatza mimenu Shaul. So firstly, why did Shaul merit such a modesty? Because he comes from Rachel. And Shaul had such a high level of being modest and humble. Esther came from Shaul. So these precedents, these spiritual genetics, as somebody once called it, I remember sort of talking about this, this was established in previous generations and carried through. And look at what the Gemara says about it. Rabbi Elazar, Shekodesh Baruch Hu posek gdula la'adam. When God, as it were, dishes out greatness to a person, posek lebanav levenei banav, it carries on through his children and his next generation, ad sof kol adorot, to the end of all the generation. Shenema, and it's a verse in the book of Job, lo yigara mitzadik einav, vet melachim lekisei, basically the idea of Netzach, that once a king has this appointment and a king has this elevation, it's something which becomes part of the family. They become elevated. And that characteristic carries on through the generations. All right, and I guess this is kind of, you know, what kings sort of talk about, you know, in terms of their position as the generations go by. But listen to this. So what was the whole modesty of Shaul? Because it says, Vayomed Dod Shaul, the uncle of Shaul, said to him, Hagidun Ali Ma Amar Lechem Shma. I heard that you met the prophet Shma. What did he say to you? Vayomer Shaul Dodo. So Shaul says to his uncle, Hagid Higid Lanu. He just told us Kinimsu Atono, that we found the animals we were looking for. That's all he reported, Shaul. Ve'devar ha'melucha, but the fact that he said, oh, by the way, you're becoming the king, lo higid lo, asher amar Shmuel, he never said a word. So Shaul wanted to keep it under his hat. As a result, zacha, he had a zechut, a merit, v'yatza mimenu Esther. Esther comes from Shaul. Dichtiv, because what does it say about Esther? Lo higide Esther dama. So according to this, it's a sign of her modesty and humility. She doesn't immediately announce who she is, where she comes from, her background, because of this inbuilt level of tzniut. This is, again, very Talmudic, very rabbinic, but again, a beautiful insight, historical insight into the character and the precedent of what Esther is doing. In other words, where does she come from? We all come from... It happened to me about 40 years ago. 40 years ago, and I think it was maybe even longer. I was born a year after my grandfather died. A year and a half. I'm named after him. I never knew him. But somebody came up to me in shul in London. I was, I don't know, maybe 20, 21 at the time. And a gentleman looks at me and he says, you must be the grandson of... And he's told my grandfather's name. I said, excuse me, how do you know that? He says, because I remember him, and you have the mannerisms, you look like him. He says, you know, you have this kind of way about you, and I just recognize, because I remember him from shul, and he used to go to Daf Yomi, and he was involved in, he lived through the Blitz in London. The Blitz in London was the most horrendous thing, because his attitude was, if the bomb is going to get me, it'll get me. He never went into the subways, and he never went into the tunnels. He went to bed every night in his bed, and the bombs were dropping all around. Good morning. And he just... Not that he didn't care. His attitude was, you know, if the good Lord is going to drop the bomb on my apartment, then so be it. You know, if my name is on the bullet, it'll get me. Whether I'm in, because unfortunately, people in the subways were also killed. So that was his attitude. But it was just so strange. There was something genetic. I can't even explain it. Something about the fact that, you know, and this happens to all of us, that we have this continuation of where we come from. Maybe in our mannerisms, the way we walk, the way we conduct ourselves, the way we speak. You know, it's just one of those strange things in human life. And here we're saying that it works on a spiritual dimension as well. That there can be a situation of King Saul who behaved with such modesty coming from the tradition of Rachel, and as a result, what happens a couple of generations, quite a long way down the line, you get Esther who also behaves in an incredibly modest way. And that again is really something beautiful. This continuation of the spiritual inheritance of the people. And of course, this is what we say as Jews. We come from the Avot, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We inherited their characteristics, their strengths, and their abilities to do what they did. We, that's why the Jews are very unique and very, very different from so many people in the world, and all this sort of stuff. And this is really, again, part of that tradition. So I wanted to mention it because I think it's just a beautiful insight. The idea of the modesty of Shaul translating itself many generations later into the modesty of Esther. All right, so let's go back to the text.
But in the Bible, we never hear of any other descendants other than Jonathan from King Saul.
No, it's not true. We really do. If you look at the beginning of Shmuel Bet, Samuel 2, you'll see there is a very, very difficult story. There's a gentleman there called Ish-Boshet. Ish-Boshet was the son of King Saul that we never heard about. For the whole of Shmuel Aleph, we never heard of him. And it turns out that this guy, Ish-Boshet, was the Rebbe, believe it or not, I think according to the rabbis, he was the Rebbe of David. He was David's teacher. So what happens is that you get this guy, and reluctantly, because there's no one left, because Saul is dead, Jonathan was killed, the two brothers are killed with him, and who's left to take over the kingship if it's going to stay within the dynasty of Saul? The answer is this poor guy, Ish-bosheth. And within four chapters of the book of Shmuel, you know what happens to him? He's assassinated. He's killed. Because he wasn't a strong man. He was a weak person, physically very weak. Even though he bore the name and bore the title, he wasn't the person. Now, the tragedy is that probably, you know, in 1936, the King of England, who wasn't meant to be the king, married the American divorcee, he abdicated, he got out. And thank God he did, because he was also a German sympathizer, that man. He's not a pleasant person. And that's a situation where he got out of it. But in this case, what we're talking about here, Ish-bosheth, he couldn't get out of it. So eventually there were two ruffians who decided, I don't know, for political reasons, they were commissioned to go and kill him, and they killed him. Tragic. So we do read about other descendants from Saul. We really do have that kind of awareness. Yeah, yeah. So look at the stories, because it's fascinating. Really interesting. Yeah.
But before Ish-bosheth became, or was looking to be king,
yeah,
Saul already was involved in that, because he was fighting Saul, and Saul was alive.
Correct. And the question was, what was going on with the whole difference between Saul and David? He was his father-in-law. I mean, you know, sometimes we can have very rough relationships with mothers-in-law, I understand that, but with his father-in-law, it's just very difficult. And it's more about Shaul than it is about David, because Shaul throws spears and he gets upset. You know, Shaul's depressed. No question in my mind, he's suffering from massive depression. Okay? Not necessarily, as some people say, he went mad. He didn't go mad, because he had so many people supporting him. You don't support a madman, you lock him up. Saul wasn't mad, Saul was depressed. And therefore, in the moments of high depression, who does he take it out on? David, because he sees David as an enemy. When in fact, later on, if you read the story through, he shows a love for David at the end, and it's tragic. Because David says, I could have killed you a dozen times, he says to Shaul. But my men wanted me to kill you. You know the story with the cave and all that whole business there, yeah? En Gedi. And it didn't happen. And the reason why he didn't kill him is because David says, I love you too much. You are the Bechir Hashem, you're the chosen one of God, the first king of Israel. How can I take a sword and kill the king of Israel? And that's what David says to him, and Shaul starts crying. And you feel that with Shaul, it just was not the right guy at the right time. There was something, with all the modesty that we've said, he just wasn't. Sorry? Yeah, and of course, that's the big question that Barbanel talks about. He says, how can you have a king from Binyamin when it's supposed to be Yehuda? And he says, because at the time there was nobody else, he was the right person, he came from the right background, his father was a gibbor, was a warrior. They had to make do, because the whole kingship was premature. Choosing a king at the time was early, they should have waited. The people wanted it because they were getting desperate. You know what, they're losing wars, and they had a problem with the ark was taken away, and that whole story. So they wanted a king to really be strong. But of course, what happens is, Shmuel says, I'm still here. You want a king, I can daven for you. You want somebody to daven, you want somebody to support you, I'm around. Why do you need a king? But eventually it says, God said to Shmuel, the people have spoken, the people have chosen. And according to the Torah, that's what it is. When the people say they want it, you got to give it to them. For better or for worse, literally. Right? And it's an interesting story. I mean, if we ever get to teach Shmuel, then we'll go through all of that, because it's so interesting. It's fascinating. And, you know, this is stuff which, you have to sort of come to terms with, the ups and downs of the beginning of kingship. But one of the things about Shaul, which is so beautiful, is in all of his craziness, if you want to call it that, all of his depression, he does maintain, when he's normal, when he's balanced, there is this element of humility. But you don't see it so much because he's depressed. And when he's depressed, you know, some say he's bipolar, I don't know, whichever definition you want to give. Got to speak to a psychology person to really get it right. But when he's out of control, he's really out of control. And David goes to the city of priests, and Saul says they harbored someone who's running away. So you've got to kill all the priests. And the people say to the king, don't do it. Sorry? Well, eventually Doeg does it, Doeg Adomi. He picks up the sword and kills them. Avner says no, Uncle Abner is Saul's uncle. He's the general of the army. And he says to his nephew, Shaul, don't do this. This is a very bad thing to do. But he insists, he's, as you say, becomes a bit crazy. becomes a bit out of control. And with Shaul, it's always the same discussion about the loss of kingship. Once he loses it, he just becomes depressed. And I can understand that. You know, he had a big chance and he blew it. And it's all to do with Amalek. You know, we'll come to all of that. When we get to Purim, we do the Haftar, which is the whole story of Saul and Amalek and how he literally lost the opportunity to continue to be the king. I want to come back to Esther, because obviously we're going down a few hundred years from there. But understanding Shaul is really understanding the roots of this story. So here she is, back to chapter 7, which is page, again, 1258. And we are looking at the beginning of chapter 7, and we just digressed a little bit to understand the phrase Esther Hamalka. She is now established as the queen, and for want of a better word, she is now comfortable with her position of royalty. Certainly when it comes to Ahasuerus, he recognizes the royalty in Esther. Look at this, verse 2. Vayomer HaMelech LeEsther Gam B'Yom HaSheni B'Mishteh HaYayin. They were in this party, and this is the second day that they were there. Ma sheilotech Esther Amalka, he calls her by her title. What is your request, Esther Amalka, v'tinatein lach, and it will be given to you. Uma bakashatech, and what is your desire, ad chatzia malchut v'teyas, up to half of the kingdom. So the rabbis say, what's Shelotech and what's Bakashatech? So Shelotech, the rabbis say, the Vilna Gaon explains, he says, Shelotech means, what do you want for yourself? Bakashatech means, what do you want for other people? Because I can see, Esther, that you are not only demanding something for yourself, but you're interested in others as well. Alright? And that's the king's perception of what Esther wants. Now here comes a real bombshell. Esther is going to spill the beans about Haman. But there is a, again, rabbinic literature is just so interesting. The rabbis say that when she spills the beans, as we will see in a minute, she, although she says Haman Harosha Azer, she's actually pointing to Ahasuerus. Because Ahasuerus was the bad guy. He was the guy that signed the edict of Haman to kill the Jews. So really, when she's actually pointing out who is the bad guy, she starts pointing at the king. The angel, whatever angel it is, comes along and says, Esther, don't do it. So he moves her hand from there, from Ahasuerus over to Haman. It's just so, I mean, you know, let's put it this way. The rabbi's imaginations were beyond belief. They really were beyond belief. And I love that. You know, it just makes the story, it just gives that, you know, instead of having the bones, you get the meat, the fat, everything else from the rabbis, and it's beautiful. Sometimes I have to say, as the rabbis say themselves, guzma, sometimes they make a bit of an exaggeration, they admit it. Right? When they say the numbers, usually in Talmud, they are grossly exaggerated. But they have a purpose for that, and it's all explained. But in this case, this is a well. So listen to this. Verse Gimel. Verse 3. Vatan Esther Malka v'Tomas. What does this say? Im matzatichem be'enecha melech, melech melech tov, if it's good and I've found favor in your eyes, tinatin li nafshi b'sheilati, for myself, I want my life. That's what I want for me. V'ami b'bakashati, the bakasha for the others is for my people. Alright? And then she explains. Ki nimkanu ani v'ami, I and my people have been sold, lashmid la'arog la'abey, to be destroyed, and completely obliterated. Ve'ilu la'avodim l'shvachot nimkanu, if we would have just been sold as slaves. And basically her point to Ahasuerus is that by issuing an order to destroy thousands upon thousands of people, you are missing out on free labor. You know, the Egyptians knew this. They used the Jews as labor. And Yemach Shemom, the Nazis, also knew this. But in Persia, they got it wrong, says Esther. She makes a point in it. She says, if we would have been sold as slaves or as manservants and maidservants, Hecharashti, I would have been silent. I wouldn't have said a word. Because you would have realized that your loss is too great. You would never have agreed. You would never have to deal with this problem because you wouldn't have lost. You would have had a free army or a very cheap army of labor. But because we have been destined for destruction, this cannot go ahead. And Vayom Pasuk, hey, listen to this. Vayom HaMelech HaShvirosh, Vayom El Esther HaMalka. So what's the problem? With all due respect, Vayomer once is okay, but why Vayomer twice? He said and he said. Say the rabbis, the Rashi jumps on this immediately. If you have the Rashi there in front of you, I'll just read it out if you don't. Kol makom shenema vayome vayome shnei pa'amim. It says vayome twice. He said and he said. What's going on? Eino ela lemidrash. Thank you, Rashi. It's all to give us a bit of midrash. This is where the rabbis kick in. Midrash shel zeh. So what's the whole midrashic explanation? Batechila hayu medabe ima. Very interesting. Al yedei sheliach. His whole system of dealing with the people below him was to talk through an intermediary. Achashverosh wouldn't talk to the common, the gardener people, right? You know, this is below him. So the first Vayomer was always, as it says here, the king spoke, it was a shaliach, he spoke through an intermediary. The king says, and this is what the person would respond to, Ba'achshav sheyoda, now he knows, shemishpachat malachim, she comes from a family of kings, she is royalty, Diber imahu batzmo, the messenger goes home, the shaliach, the agent, and Achashverosh talks directly to Esther. It's the ultimate compliment when the Queen of England actually has that conversation with you. I'll tell you a little story. My father-in-law, Zichron Livracha, got an award from London University, a very, very interesting award. And it was a whole ceremony, and it was after all the BAs and MAs and PhDs, he was right at the end. Doctor of Science. And who gave him the award? Princess Anne, the daughter of the Queen. Right? And this was the whole thing, and she had to put a hood on his head, and there was a whole Shiloh about chutneys, and he asked a whole bunch of questions about it. But he went. And he's sitting there for 3 hours waiting for this ceremony to end, because he's the last one to get the degree. There's two guys at the end. And as he goes up, Princess Anne, who was falling asleep through most of the ceremony, I have to say, when he goes up at the end, she starts having a conversation with him. And this was the ultimate honor, because she didn't speak to anybody else. But, you know, you get the biggest award, you get a conversation with Princess Anne. Wonderful. The only problem was, when we said to her, what did she say to you after? What did she say? So, being my father-in-law, being a very honest Yeki, he said, I don't remember a word. I was so desperate for the bathroom, he says, that I just had to get out of there. And this was his comment. And we said, but you spoke to Princess Anne. How could you not remember? What did she say? You know, did she say something amazing? Can't remember a word, he says. I just had to run. And it was so funny. At the time, but you know, this is one of the things. It was one of these, I would call it not dubious honors, but let's say it's an honor that people do cherish if you ever had a word with one of the royals. I tell a story, my neighbor that I lived in London, she worked for Princess Diana. I don't know if I told this to you, I may not have mentioned it. She worked for Diana, she was a dress designer, from lady, with a shaitel, the whole works. And she used to go to the palace wherever Diana was living with Charles at the time, you know, when they got married. And she went to do her dresses every week. So the first week she went there, Diana was very polite, very pleasant, as you can imagine. And she had tea and what they call in England, biscuits, right? Tea and cookies. So this woman, my neighbor, was a wonderful lady, only passed away maybe 2 or 3 years ago. She came into the room and she said, Princess, with all due respect, I'll have the tea. Right, the milk, she wasn't worried about the Chol of Yisrael or not, but she said, the cookies, they're not kosher, can't have the cookies. And Diana accepted it, and that was the end of the story. She came back a week later, there's tea, and there's kosher cookies sitting on the table. So what's the story? So Diana says, I must tell, her name was Judith. Judith, I must tell you that the story of the cookies. The story of the cookies is like this. I have this lady in waiting, Miss whatever her name is, and I sent her to Harrods to buy kosher cookies. And you know what happened? She came back and said, Harrods haven't got kosher cookies. Right? She couldn't find the kosher department. There's a little somewhere there that they sell kosher cookies. So Diana said, this was not good enough. I got in the car, she said, and I went to Harrods. Imagine the guy serving must have died when she walked in. You know, everybody's standing there. All of a sudden, Diana, because she was a film star wherever she went, she walks into Harrods and she says, where's the kosher counter? Everybody was going nuts at this point. What is Diana doing? Is she becoming Jewish? What's happened to this woman? And she bought the cookies herself. She said, I can't have you here for another week without having something to eat. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Great story. And what was so sad, she showed me that they used to get Christmas cards from Diana and Charles every year. The first Christmas card, they're standing in the middle together and all of the family around them. Right, meaning all the other members of the royal family. They made that sort of Christmas card. By the end, Diana was at one end, and Charles was at the other end. So sad. And of course they got divorced, and then the rest is history. Just an unbelievable story, and all this was happening across the road from where I was living. Quite amazing. There you go. So again, when you're dealing with royalty, you're dealing with something very unique, very different. So let's go back to the story. Let's see what's going on here. Pasuk Hey, Vayomah HaMelech HaShverosh, Yom HaNester HaMalkos, and now he's talking directly to her. Mi Ozev Esa, who, this wonderful statement that he said, who is it? Hashem Alo Libo Lasot Kein, that his heart was filled to do this. And he knows, he's a hypocrite, because he knows that he knows exactly who's responsible, because he signed the edict. So Achashverosh is making out as if he doesn't know. Vatoma Esther, so Esther then says, Ishtzar V'oyev Haman Hara Hazeh, pointing to Haman. But the rabbis say, why did she have to say Hazeh? Because her finger was actually pointing at Achashverosh. She was going to say, you're responsible. But as the rabbis put it, the angel came and moved her hand, Hazeh, to Haman. Alright, and of course, what happens to Haman? For Haman nivat mifnei amelech b'malka, and of course, he becomes, to want of a better word, completely terrified. It says shocked. He just doesn't know what's going to be next. And says the story, and of course, we just go through to the end of the chapter. V'amelech kom b'chamato mishteyayah, and the king was very angry, because he now realizes that maybe what he suspected, Haman and Esther were in cahoots. It's not really true. Esther was actually a friend, and Haman was the bad guy, even for Achashverosh. So he gets very angry. El Ginata Bitan, he goes out into the garden. For Haman Omad Levakesh al Nafsho Esther Amalk, he now goes Haman to Esther, and he's begging for his life. Because he saw that this is no good. The king is now going to do something evil to him, and he's begging. And the king comes in, and of course the rabbis make a big deal about this. He comes back into the room where all of the meal was going on. That angel was very busy. Haman was standing next to Esther, and he was near to a couch, and he pushed him over. The angel came along, gave Haman a shove, and of course, what does it look like? He's trying to attack Esther. He's trying to have, essentially, to rape her. And the king walks in at that moment. So you can imagine this was not very good for Haman. Asher Esther Olea, the bed on which Esther was sitting, Vayomer HaMelech Hagam, and this is a famous phrase, Hagam Lichvoshet HaMalkimi Babai, not only do you want to have an attack on me, but you want to conquer the queen and while I'm here, Chutzpah Haman, you're disgusting. Hadavah Yatzah Mipi HaMelech Bnei Haman Chafu. And the rabbis say Chafu means they covered his face. Because apparently the Persian custom was, when someone was destined to be, as they say, for the chop, he was covered over. This was already, like in the courts in certain countries where they have death penalty, the judge would put on a black cloth or something when he announces the person is to be hanged or whatever. And in this case, in Persia, it was Khafu. They covered his face. Now, Vayomer Charvoina, all of a sudden, this guy pops out of nowhere. Right, as Rav Lau puts it so brilliantly, he says he comes out of the closet. Where's he been? Charvona, the great friend of the Jewish people. Where is he? All of a sudden he's there. There's a wonderful word that Rav Lau uses for him, opportunist. Modern Hebrew word, right? Wonder what it means. Opportunist. Okay? It's on the page on the other side of the page. An opportunist. Believe it or not, that's the Hebrew. So you learn some Ivrit. So one of the officers comes before the king and he speaks up. Here's Mordechai, he's your friend. And there's the tree that Haman made, the gallows which he wants to hang your friend. And Omeh Bebeit Haman, and it's in his garden, you can't miss it because it's 50 amos, 100 feet tall. Go, Gavah, Chamishim Amah, Vayomeh HaMelech, Telu Alav, hang him. And again, one always understands how Melech has got the double nuance, not only of King Achashverosh, but also King of the world, Hashem. So this was the decree. Vayidvat Haman ala Eitzah Sheikhin la Mordechai, that the very tree that had been prepared for Mordechai, Haman was hanged. Vachamat HaMelech Shechacha, and the anger of the king subsided. Now, look at the page that I gave you, and have a look at this, because this is fascinating. I said, look at section C. Just a little bit, because it's so interesting. Section B, which I just told you verbally, was the whole thing about pointing the fingers at the different people. Section C is the discussion amongst the trees. This is taken again from Talmud Megillah. It's all in the Gemara. Listen to the trees having a discussion about which one has to be Nebuch, the Korban, as it were, to hang Haman. So look at this. It's section C at the bottom. Ala Eitzah Sheikhin LeMordechai. Alav HaKatuv, about six lines from the bottom of the right hand side. Alav HaKatuv Omer says about two lines down, excuse me. Ma Eitz Hayah. What tree was it? Only the rabbis will be interested to find out what was the tree, which species, right? Amru Chachamim. So here comes a rabbinic discussion like you've never heard before. B'sha'ah sheba lachino. When they come to prepare the tree, kara kodesh bochu leitzim v'amar lahem miyitei nafsho v'yitleh rasha aleh. I know that this evil man is going to be hanged on this tree eventually. Which tree wants to have that particular dubious honor? Says God to the trees. Right? This is a good discussion for those who are into ecology and environment. Te'enamra. So the fig tree. Tamar is the fig, Tena is the date. Excuse me. The date, whatever date tree is, Aniyate Nafshi, Shemimeni Mavim, Bikurim, it says that I am prepared to sacrifice because the first fruits come from me. Gulo'odela Shebi Nimshala Knesset Yisrael, the tribe of Israel is compared to the date. Shinema Kibakhara Bateina Barishita Ra'iti Avotechem. The fathers of Israel were like dates. They had this beautiful presentation in front of God. That was the date tree. So that the date tree offered. Gefen Omra. Go to the. You see where it goes. That box continues under the word finger. There's the continuation. Gefen. What did the vine say? Ani atein nafshi. I'm prepared. Shebi nimshala Yisrael shenema gefen Yisrael tasiya. That the vine was also used to compare to the Jewish people. Then Rimon, along comes the pomegranate tree. I don't know, whatever that is. Oh man, I'll do it. Yeah, they're all lining up. Shebi nimshala Yisrael shenema kepelach haRimon rakatech. A verse from the Shir HaShirim comparing Israel to the pomegranate. You know, the idea of 613 pits and mitzvahs, right? Ego zoma. So the nut tree came along, whatever nut it was. Aniyate nafshi. So interesting. Shebid imshala Yisrael. Shenema el ginat egoz yaradati. Again, a verse from the Song of Songs, talking about this place where the trees were laden with these egozim, with these nuts, which again was a symbol for the Jewish people. Etrog oma. Thank goodness. The etrog tree. I've actually seen one in Israel. They use me to praise God because the etrog is used on Sukkot. Go down two lines, Tamar. Then you've got the Tamarim. You've got the just a second. So Tamar Amar. So this is the date tree. Sorry. So before we had Teina was the fig tree. Excuse me. Here's the date tree. Tamar Amar. Again, they use the dates for a mitzvah. I'm not sure, but I suppose it's talking about Bikurim again. Hadas, then the Hadas tree comes along. I'll just read the names of the trees. The Zayit, the olive tree, which is quite a big tree, then comes along. Tapuachama, and then the apple tree offers. And then Arava Omra, then the willow says. All these trees were lining up. And then Erez, the cedar tree, says, finally, where you see it says thorn tree. That little paragraph. Boto sha'ah bokotz lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A little thorn came before God. For Amar lefonov, and the thorn said, Ribono shel Olam, O Master of the world, Ein lefenecha lo masa panim lo mekach shoka. I know you don't take bribes. V'chol ma shebarata bo lamecha lichvodecha barata. You created everything for a purpose. The elu kula matzulem zechut, and all of these other trees that want to hang home on, they've all got their own merit. They can be the etrog, and they can be the rimon, the pomegranate, whatever it is. Shelo lechinam nivra. I know that they were not created without a purpose. V'ani, but I'm a thorn. Who wants thorns in this world? Ani lama ani bolamecha. Why am I here? A thorn tree. Everybody curses me when they go into the thorns. They get hurt. What am I here for? She'ein li zechut, I don't have a merit. V'lo pitchom peh lefanecha, I can't even stand before you to argue my case. Ele'im kasher davar be'inecha, but if it's correct, if you listen to what I have to say, melech olam, O King of the world, yitle kotsetz ben kotsetz alayim. Let the thorn, the son of a thorn, be hanged on me. Right? The thorn to the thorn. Measure for measure. Unbelievable. Yavo min etzel mino. The species comes to its species. In other words, he's a thorn in the pain in the side. He's going to be hanging on a tree, which is also a thorn tree. Shneeman, he brings a whole pasuk. Look at the next, just the last five lines. Miyad kibela kodesh baruch hu mimenu v'nitle alav. Hu obana. The thorn tree became the tree, whatever that tree is. A lot of thorns. V'kayim bo kodesh baruch hu masha ne'emar. God fulfilled. Bor korov yachbereu v'yapel b'shachas yifol. A pit was dark. The Medrash says that in such a case, that because of this dilemma of all the trees having a merit, and the thorn tree was the one that had no merit, I suppose again to make the point, there's nothing in this world without a purpose. And even a thorn, you know, the famous story of the spider. Everybody asks, what is the purpose of a spider? Everybody's arachnophobia, right? We all hate spiders. Turns out, David HaMelech, without the spider covering over the entrance to the cave, the famous thing, he would have been found by Sheol. So that's, again, you know, you have this discussion over and over again in rabbinic literature, the purpose of nature, the purpose of creations in the world. And I just love this concept because, again, we're so into this at the moment. There's this girl in Sweden, right, who's generating a whole dilemma for all the leaders of the world economic communities. She was just in Switzerland, right? You read the whole story. And she's 17 years old. She's got no life experience whatsoever. And everybody's taking her word because she's, for the press, it's perfect. You know, it's David and Goliath, right? She's the little David, and America and all the other countries are the Goliaths, and she's fighting them. So this is perfect for the nature of the press, but it's pretty scary. But you see that the rabbis already were sensitive to the purpose of all of the different elements of creation. So who knew that even the tree that on which Mordechai was supposedly going to be hanged, and Haman ends up being hanged. That tree itself was a whole discussion in rabbinic literature. Turn over, just have a look at this. This is a wonder. I'm going to just do it from where it says number 2. And this is the discussion, we've got a few minutes, about Charvona. Listen to how Rav Lau talks about Charvona. It is really extraordinary. He says, Nasim lev makareka. Let's see, think about what's going on here. Please listen, because it's really unbelievable. He says, Amelech kevaich lit. Firstly, the king realized Haman has no boundaries. He's prepared to attack the queen, even in the palace. Kol mi shenimtza b'sviva, anyone around, mevin shehaman siyem et tkufat ha'edna shelo. Haman is now out of favor completely. So what his wife and all of his advisors said to him, you're falling, and he's about to fall. Everybody knows. Akshan, at this moment, Rak bin Akuda Zo, Besipor Megillah, at this point of the Megillah, Echad Asarisim Yotzei Min Aron. There's one officer, he comes out of the cupboard, comes out of the closet, Umaflil et Haman, and he accuses Haman. Haman, he says, that's the tree that he was going to hang your friend, Mordechai, and he put it in his garden, and he tells the whole story. Vashomeo made Navoch. So whoever's listening is slightly perplexed. You, Charvona, your daughter Kolazmat, you knew about this all the time. Not just now. Shehaman mechineta es lemoda. You knew Haman was preparing the tree because you were part of the conspiracy. And therefore, adachshav shatakta, now till now you were quiet. Veraka edge, kishabaru mi menatzech. Now you see who is winning the battle and is actually going to be Mordechai and not Haman. All of a sudden, atah mityasev letzido. You take up sides with the one who's winning. Right? What he calls here, Zegvuratam Sha'aluvim, these are the most despicable people. Right? We're talking maybe about politicians as well. He says, Svu'im, these are hypocrites, Vashel, opportunistim, opportunists. And boy, do they exist around the world. And he says, Et akriyazo animotse midrash hachamim, and he says, I've actually seen this in the Gemara, and I see it in other places. Look at the final column. And we're going to finish with this, because this is precious. He says, the final column, which is on that page. Kulanu makirim. We all know it, the tipus hazeh. We've all met this sort of guy before. Kishashalit bachar litalel bayudim. Particularly when it comes to attacking the Jews. Acharvona haya harishon sheizgir otam. Chavona was the first one to give them away, to want to attack them. Hiflil, and there's all midrashim about Chavona, which I'm not going to go into now, but Hiflil otam, now he stands up for them. V'akol mitok magamat litztayen. He wants to shine, he wants to prove his loyalty. Kishotosh shalit hitmotet. When Haman fails, Acharvona yarishon lirgom ba'avanim. Chavona was the first one to throw stones at him. Now, Lamrot adavarim pshutim ha'elah. Now, apart from these obvious things, Ba'echa mechachmei midrash Rabbi Pinchas. There is a rabbi in the midrash called Rabbi Pinchas. What does he say? V'kava klal ledorot. Gam charvona zachur latom. Not only charvona should be remembered for what he did then, but forever and ever. Question is why? Why do we give charvona such a good press? Right? Chavona was not a good guy. He was the guy that was in on the plot to kill Mordechai. He's an opportunist when he sees things going against Haman, so he changes and goes against Haman. And this is the guy that we say in the Shoshana Siyako, look what we say, Gam Charvona Zachor Latov. He should be remembered for good. You know, there's something strange here. Says Rabbi Lau, this is the thought for the day. He says, Lamrot Shel Charvona. We know that his personality was very shady, to put it mildly. Charvona. Hadarshan mevakesh lachlil oto b'tok kvutzat ha-tovim. In the end of the day, he's included amongst the good guys. Why? Eile she'ein lehokiyam o lakotam, ele yesh lechabdam l'shabcham. These are the ones you praise. But he's not a good guy. He's really a very low life. Zechuto shel Charvona omedet lo b'shel ha-milim. Gam in Eight. That's the Gam Charvona. Not also Charvona is remembered for good, but the Gam, when Charvona said the word Gam, referring to the tree, because he said Gam Eight, to use that word Gam, that word Gam of Charvona is to be remembered. But what does he mean? Who's Zesh Amenatzelet Rega Hakash Alamela? He jumped in when the king was angry. Uma'avird Machshavto Ra'al Ma'aseh Sofin. He translated the king's anger into an action. What happened? Vayoma Amalek Tulu Allah. The king said, "Hang Haman," and he was hanged. B'chatzar ha'pachpacha k'mosh shel Achashverosh. When Achashverosh changes and chops and changes backwards and forwards and all over the place, efshari gam tarchish shebo ha'melech mitztanei mika'aso. And Charvona in the end maybe was taking a bit of a chance because the king might have gone away from his anger. U'machlid la'roget Mordechai v'Esther. He could have killed Mordechai and Esther. The king was unpredictable. Lama kacha. That's the way the king is. So, you know, no explanation. Ba charvonai sherazeh, this evil man comes along, umesayel lemimush hasofiyut shel hamikrim hamitchapchim b'megillah. He is the one who typifies the change in the Megillah, going from bad to good or from good to bad. Bizchuto nitle Haman, in his merit Haman is hanged, v'nistaymar parsha, and that parsha is ended. Al-Kain, a Midrash, Zocher Tolatovah, the Midrash remembers him for good. But says Rabbi Lau, the most fantastic thing, he says that this Rabbi Pinchas, who is explaining this whole thing about Charvona, is telling us something about Jewish history, and Jewish existence, and the remarkable miracle that was still around to tell the story. And this is the final paragraph, and I always argue there's one item that's worth, at least one item worth coming out to hear. This is it. Listen to this. Yitachen she'alekach she'Rabbi Pinchas mevakesh lamei b'midrash chashuv yoter mecharvona atzmo. The message is really of Rabbi Pinchas is more important than Charvon himself. Hai hayinu rotzim lirot at agula. We have redemption. We're going through the process. Kibbutz Galiot, Jews are returning to Israel. Thank God, 7 million Jews living in Israel. Kol suk shagula, and any type of redemption, ba'am imakom mushlam. Naki mezukat. We hope that it comes from a clean, a pure source. It comes from a holy place. Molei b'mesirat nefesh u'bakrava, full of all the highest levels of sacrifice that we expect the redemption to be. He says, in reality, it's not like that. Ela shamatziyut tamid achura yoter. Things are much more cloudy. What does that mean? Lechol maaseh mitztafim kochot shemonim mimotivatzio pratiyot. Anashim mechashvim chishuvim pratiyim, ach bepoel notnim yad lecholel tshua. God plans, and we can't understand this, but there are elements that come together, and salvation comes from a place that you can never imagine. 1917, when Balfour in London signed the Balfour Declaration, and the letter, the famous letter he sent to Lord Rothschild at the time, everybody saw in that act the messianic overturn. They were dancing in the streets all over Eastern Europe when they heard about it. The Chofetz Chaim even talks about it, people, the rabbinic leadership, that this is a moment of redemption. Where's it coming from? It's coming from the British that for the next 30 years were the most hated people in Israel. And even to this day, a lot of people still don't like the Brits in Israel, right, for what they did for those 30 years. And nevertheless, that's where the salvation comes from. And this is something which, again, we can't explain. We've got a president who, I can honestly say, and I'm not even upset about putting it on tape, that the guy is, unfortunately, absolutely crazy. We know this. Let's put it this way. Let's use the word unpredictable, what he does. And nevertheless, for Israel, there hasn't been a president, probably in all the history, of the modern history of Israel, that has been so pro-Israel ever as this president at the moment. Whether you like his politics, I'm not even going to go into that. But the reality is, you've just got to recognize the fact. But where is the salvation coming from? From someone who is so unpredictable and so difficult to understand. And his motivations are sometimes, maybe most of the time, extremely strange and sometimes very doubtful and who knows what. When it comes to this attitude to Israel, I don't remember such a positive relationship, and certainly in Israel they are overwhelmed by it. In this country I would say the Jewish community is out to lunch about the whole thing, but when it comes to this attitude in Israel, they recognize there is a salvation coming from a source that we don't even know, a source that we can't even recognize where it's coming from, but once it happens we put two and two together. And he says that's gam charvona zacholata. It's not about the person. It's about the fact that when a salvation comes about, it comes from a place that we can't begin to imagine it would ever come from, a place like Chavona, the man who was involved with the original plot to destroy the Jews. He becomes the focus of salvation. Go figure. Says Rabbi Lau, this is an amazing thing. He says again, it's about six lines from the bottom. He says, Elisha Metziyut Tamid Achura Yoteh, four lines into that paragraph. L'chol ma'aseh mitztarfim kochot shemonim motivatzeh pratiyot, anashim mechashvim chishuvim pratiyot. Many people have their own personal calculation. Ach b'po'el not dimyad l'cholel tshua haratzon. V'haratzon liyot toho hu nachlatam shanashim gvohim, ach lo ma'asim. Sometimes the redemption comes, but not necessarily from the most practical, from the most pure source. Right? This is a very big statement about Zionism. The reality is that we don't like a lot of the features of the secular state of Israel. It's not religious. You go there and whatever. There's a beautiful story. A great Rosh Yeshiva from London went to Israel in 1958. And he walked the streets of Yerushalayim and Bnei Brak and whatever. And he came back and he just couldn't talk enough about it. He was so overwhelmed with what he saw. So some of his students said, but Rebbe, we heard this Chilul Shabbat. And they're not observant, and there's terrible things going on, and the buses are running. What's going on? He said, Matonit Zogin, he said, you mustn't say that about Eretz Yisrael. So they said, what do you mean? He says, David HaMelech gave us, they gave us the guideline, Re'eh B'tuv Yerushalayim. When you see the good of Jerusalem, that's what you've got to do. Don't look for the bad. Look always for the good. The reality is, and not only that, but even from things which you think are bad, you know what? A salvation can come from there as well. And read Rabbi Lau's life history, Yisrael Lau, when he talks about the whole discussion about running trains on Shabbat, and how one of the members of the Knesset, who was anti-religious, made a concession that the train service to Nahariya from Tel Aviv, which the British built it, is not running on Shabbat, even in 1948. And there's a whole discussion, you don't expect this man, and the man says to the rabbi, Rabbi Lau's uncle, who asked him not to run the trains, he said, you didn't think there was such a, that an Apicurus like me can give you such a blessing. This is what the comment was from the minister of the Israeli government, called himself an Apicurus. Alright, whatever. But the reality is that those trains are not running, haven't been running ever since. The salvation sometimes comes from the strangest places. Gam charvona zacholata, when we say this in about 6 weeks' time, we need to remember it's not about the person as much as it is about the principle. Even a Charvona who is so against the existence of Am Yisrael, he was such a supporter of Haman, when it comes to the crunch, even he can be the salvation of the Jewish people. And if the Geula is going to come from non-observant or irreligious, this whole thing of Rav Kook looked at the Chalutzim and said they're not observant, but they are, he said to his people. So they said, Rebbe, what do you mean? They don't keep Shabbos. He says they're doing the greatest mitzvah of building Eretz Yisrael. They're draining the swamps. This is going back into the 30s and the 20s. Rav Kook was so positive when all the other leaders, all the other rabbinic leaders were indifferent, to put it mildly. And of course, the ones who said, stay in Europe and everything will be fine, well, we know what happened with that piece of advice. How tragic that is. And says Rav Lau at the end, HaMasoret shel Charvona zachur latov, this tradition of Charvona should be remembered for good, Melamedet otanu et tfunat egayon politi, teaches us sometimes about the political logic, HaMazukak pachot ach mo'il yoter. It may be less refined, but it can have a great effect. And of course, now we're sitting on the edge of a new peace plan. Let's hope that this is the case. It may come, who knows from where. You know, someone will be able to twist an arm and to break a couple of heads, and you never know, maybe we're looking at a new period in Jewish history. I hope, I pray, the lesson of our time for salvation and redemption. How beautiful that is. Gam Charvona Zachor Lato. Next week, chapter 8, the aftermath. What we do with chapter 8 is a very big challenge. Okay? Because at the end of the day, it seems to be the clear and present danger has gone, but it hasn't. And this is where it gets very interesting. The politics of Persia kick in once again. This is to be continued, Ms. Hashem, next Wednesday. Thank you, everybody. I do, but I don't have it with me. But I'll tell you my email in a second. Maybe email me and I can send it through to you. That would be useful. In the meantime, everybody, have a great day. Thank you so much.